Division.
What is Dick's last name again, please?
Dumit. Richard Dumit.
Good.
On several occasions, we have brought before the various committees the problem that the Department of Revenue is experiencing with the growth in our accounts receivable. This bill has three elements which would help us address this problem, but it would not be the sole cure for the problem with the growth in the accounts receivable. The three elements which the committee person mentioned would have a small impact, but they're only some of the methods that the department is looking at addressing this problem. Today I'd like to talk mainly how these will apply to the personal income tax program. The three elements in the bill that we have are the first one would permit the Department of Revenue to accept bank cards for payment of delinquent liabilities. The second one would permit the Department of Revenue to assess a penalty for non-sufficient fund checks which had been tendered to the department. And the third would provide for the collection of gift and inheritance distraint warrants in the collection process. What I'd like to do is go through the bill, these three sections separately, and give the committee a chance to respond with any questions that they might have.
Go ahead.
The first segment in the bill is found in Section 2, and this deals with payment of delinquent liabilities by bank card. We see that there would be two main areas where we would use this. One would be in the personal income tax program, and the other would be in the other agency account program. The payment by bank cards would be restricted to payment of delinquent liabilities. In other words, the taxpayer would not be filing a return and say, put my $500 balance on Visa. This would only be used in the collection process. Currently, the only state that is using bank card payments is the state of Alaska. There are several state agencies which use bank card payments, and these would include the state colleges and universities for educational loans and expenses, and the Oregon Health Sciences University, which uses bank cards for payment of medical liabilities. Under this bill, the department would be paying a discount rate of 1.5% to 2.5% based on the volume of transactions which we would process. We would use a terminal to approve payments both on Visa, MasterCard, and American Express. And once we had called in and got approval, this would lock those funds in until the transaction could be processed. In the collection process, the taxpayer now has two options. They can either pay the account in full or they can pay the account within 90 days. By using bank cards, this would give the taxpayer a third option for paying his delinquent liabilities. It would also transfer these delinquent liabilities to a lending institution, which is in the business to loan money on an extended period of time, for an extended period of time.
Okay, go ahead.
The second segment of the bill is found in Section 3. This would give the Department of Revenue authority to assess a civil penalty against a person who wrote a non-sufficient fund check to the department. The penalty would be three times the amount of the check, with a minimum of $100 and a maximum of $500. This is comparable to the same penalty which can be assessed in the private sector. The department currently receives about 1,700 non-sufficient fund checks per year, with an average amount of those checks of $600. This penalty would be in addition to the 5% late penalty which is currently added when a check is returned from the bank. We've seen a large increase in the amount of non-sufficient fund accounts which we have set up in our system. From 1981 to 1984, we've seen a 300% increase in the number of accounts which are set up which result directly from a non-sufficient fund check. This penalty would be assessed only against repeat offenders. So you would not be assessing this penalty. Let me give the committee a situation where a taxpayer who has not written a lot of checks, and maybe their spouse dies, and now the other spouse writes a check to us not realizing that there isn't money in the bank or that the deposits were not made. This would be the first time, in most cases, where that taxpayer had written a check. What we're looking at doing is assessing this penalty against a blatant offender or someone who has repeatedly issued non-sufficient fund checks. An example of this is we have a firm in the Portland area which we have had a collection problem with for some time. And in the last several years, they've had a large payroll. but in the last year they have written us several non-sufficient fund checks for $15,000 or $20,000. In contacting these people to discuss why we were receiving the non-sufficient fund check, the person that we talked to said, well, we assume that this is a standard business practice, that this is, you know, something that's done by everybody, that you, the Department of Revenue, should just go ahead and redeposit these checks because eventually the money will be there. So this type of person is repeatedly writing the check and blatantly abusing this privilege.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Under this bill, the taxpayer would be afforded the same appeal rights as they would in any other action which is taken by the department, where they would be able to have a conference, hearing, or appeal it to the tax court.
Okay, would you go over the penalty again, please?
Okay, the penalty, Mr. Chairman, the penalty which we would be assessing would be three times the amount of the check, with a minimum of $100 and a maximum of $500. So you're really, the penalty would be between $100 and $500.
Okay, now, you're making this applicable to all persons, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So that if this were a person that had a small liability, say $40, and the check bounced the first time and they wrote you another one and it bounced again, you would assess them a minimum of $100?
Mr. Chairman, the main area where this is going to come into play is in the withholding tax section or in the other agency account section. And part of the reason why it would not apply in the personal income tax program is because that's a once-a-year filing. So unless it's in the actual collection process. But yes, there could be a situation where someone had written a check, but it would have to be on a repeat offender where someone had written a check more than once. And that would not be the same check. That would be a different check. Because currently we redeposit the checks that come back non-sufficient funds.
Okay, your language, however, does not differentiate between personal income tax payments and or corporate or agency, right?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. And then this penalty could be assessed in any of the tax programs. These are the two main ones that we would see because we're dealing with a repeat type person on an ongoing basis.
Okay, go ahead.
The third segment of the bill gives the department the distraint warrant authority in the gift and inheritance tax programs. And this would also simplify our administrative process in this program. The current process that we go through now in the gift and inheritance program is if a taxpayer refuses to pay, make voluntary payment, then we send this account to the Department of Justice. An attorney at the Department of Justice files a petition in tax court to obtain a judgment. And then we would attempt to locate any assets and levy on any assets that taxpayer may have to force compliance of the obligation. The obligation must also be collected within a six-year period. There's a six-year statute of limitations currently. Under the new concept of this bill, this six-year statute of limitations would be removed, which would bring this in line with all of the other tax programs that we administer in the personal withholding and corporate tax programs. One of the reasons why we're looking at changing this is because it's a costly process and it's also a very time-consuming process. What under the concept of this bill, it would permit us to file a distraint warrant, which we currently do in our other tax programs. And this is just a matter of filing the lien, sending out a demand notice to the taxpayer, filing a warrant, which becomes a lien against the taxpayer. And at that point, then we can execute on any assets that the taxpayer may have. And this is the same process that's used in the other tax programs which we administer. In reviewing the accounts that are currently in this program, this is also a situation where we would not be issuing a great deal of warrants. In looking at the number of accounts that we have, we would not anticipate that we would be issuing more than 20 warrants a year. And the gift and inheritance tax also sunsets in January of 1987. So this is something to get through the accounts that are currently in the system. But there would be, even after the tax sunsets, a three-year audit period where we could go back and assess tax.
Now, is it both gift and inheritance that sunsets?
That's correct.
Yes.
Gift and inheritance? Pardon? The gift and inheritance tax sunset.
Yes. Correct, both sunset.
Go ahead.
That's
it, huh?
That's it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Hebel.
The reason we want the penalty, the bad check penalty, is because you're finding a pattern in practice of certain firms operating under the assumption that everybody is writing bad checks, whether withholding, and this would stop that, or would at least show that it's not common practice.
Okay. Representative Hugo, what we feel that this would do is this would be some sort of a deterrent, and it would also be an additional penalty for the people that would be the repeat offenders that would be writing non-sufficient fund checks.
Are there quite a few of those repeat offenders out there?
Well, we have the number of repeat offenders at this point, we aren't able to go in and determine an exact number. In doing a survey that we did with the revenue agents in the collection units, we anticipated that there would not be more than approximately 50 instances where we would assess the penalty.
Okay, that was my question. The question really was a revenue impact question to Steve, I suppose. The revenue impact of this bill is insignificant according to the revenue report. And I was wondering if we're going to put out $500 fines against several hundreds of employers.
Okay. No, we would not.
Okay, any other questions? Any other comments?
No, Mr. Chairman. Good bill to pass.
Richard, do you have anything to add?
Oh, Your Honor, no, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other witnesses on Senate Bill 181? Okay, the hearing is closed on Senate Bill 181 and opened on Senate Bill 182. Jim Brown? Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, that's Senate Bill 182 should be the following tab. It deals with withholding tax changes so that the department wants some discretion to modify the withholding method for certain employers that the current method can be a burden on. And then it also would exempt ministers from income tax withholding and make changes in the beginning date for interest starting on withholding tax payments and has an effective date also of 1986 tax year.
Okay.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jim Brown. I'm the administrator of the Collection Division for the Department of Revenue. If you'll recall, back in the special session of 1982, the legislature passed a bill that would revise or speed up the time in which employers paid their withholding taxes over to the state of Oregon. Prior to that time, we had employers, the larger employers in the state, paying us monthly, smaller group paying us on a quarterly basis. The legislation was designed to bring about $65 million that would have come in the 81-83 biennium. It moved it up into the 81-83 biennium so that in order to balance the budget, that was done. The intent at the time was if we were speeding that money up to make it as easy as possible on employers in the state, we would tie to the federal due dates for the withholding payments. So the legislation that was passed essentially did that, and we now look to the date that an employer is required to deposit their federal taxes for the date that they're also required to pay the state taxes. This bill tightens the conformity to federal law in three specific areas. The first area is found on the first page of the bill under Section 2 on lines 7 and 8, and what that section does is it gives us some flexibility to go away from federal payment dates if it makes sense to do that. And I might just give you a couple of examples of situations that we've come across in our 2.5 year experience with the program that we would be using this flexibility in. I might also point out that the federal payment requirements are found in regulation, not in the Federal Internal Revenue Code, so that the federal government has this type of flexibility, and that's what we're looking toward. The first letter, I just maybe read you a couple quotes out of this letter. It deals with a very large corporation that they say, because we are a large corporation with over 4,000 employees, we are required to pay federal taxes each week. Although we have only 15 employees in Oregon and collect a little over $300 a week in Oregon withholding taxes, we have been making weekly remittances in order to be consistent with the timing of the federal remittances. So that is one circumstance where, because they are so large on a federal scale, when you tie them into Oregon, they pay us very often. So we get 52 deposits of $300, and it does very little for us, and very little for the cash flow, and causes both us and the employers a lot of work. A second example is one that's probably even a little more significant. It's an employer in Vancouver area that does all their work out of state but hires some Oregon employees. And they were not paying according to the new schedule, so our computer program billed them for penalty for making late payment. And their response back says, we are returning the above assessments for cancellation. During 1982, we withheld Oregon taxes for the convenience of our employees who are Oregon residents but work at our Washington construction site. We are not required to withhold Oregon taxes because we have no nexus in Oregon. We have only no Oregon payroll, no property, no revenues. We are no longer withholding Oregon taxes because of the administrative nightmares caused by the Oregon bureaucracy far outweigh any employee goodwill. So essentially what we're looking for is the flexibility to deal with those kind of problems and be able to tell those employers that under those type of circumstances that you can pay on a schedule that makes sense both to the state and to you. That's the first element of the bill. The second element is to exempt ministers from withholding, as Steve indicated, and that is found on the second page of the bill on line 11. And again, that's merely tying to the federal law. Federal currently exempts these people from withholding. And the problem we run into is that you get a lot of people that do on a voluntary basis do bookkeeping for churches. And when you have a situation where they have to withhold for Oregon on the minister's salaries, not withhold from federal on those salaries, it gets to be very confusing for those people. And it's a small amount. We estimate there's less than 4,000 people in the state that would come under this category. Those people currently are considered self-employed by federal. They make estimated payments, and they would do the same for Oregon. They would fall under our estimated tax program. The last portion of the bill is found on the second page on line 40, and essentially all this does is change the interest starting date for late payments to be consistent with the federal treatment. For example, if I'm an employer and I'm required to make a deposit on January 15th of withheld taxes. If I make that deposit late, if I make it, say, on January 31st, under current federal law, there's a 5% penalty for the late payment, but there's no interest as long as the payment is in by the due date of the quarterly return, which would be April 30th. Under Oregon law, there is a penalty of 5% for the late payment, and there is interest calculated from the date that the payment is required to be made, January 15th, through the date it was made, January 31st. The problem that causes us is if you have an employer that you can have a maximum of 8 deposits required a month under the federal and the Oregon system. So you can have a quarterly return with up to 24 deposits, all of which were made late, and you have 24 separate interest calculations to determine how much that person now owes. And it becomes a nightmare. We have some very, very sophisticated computer programs to determine that amount, calculate the bill. It sends the taxpayer a billing that shows you paid some of your payments late, here's the penalty, and here's the interest. Then they'll call our agents up and say, I don't understand how you arrived at the amount of interest. And we have to go through an explanation of 24 separate interest calculations for very little amount of money. So we think it would be make more sense to be consistent with the federal treatment and make that interest starting date the day of the return, and then there would be one simple calculation for us. That's essentially the three elements of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this question, I'll leave it to your discussion, is a legal question that we could get a response on. Maybe it isn't appropriate here, but I'll ask it anyway. Page 1 of the bill, lines 7 and 8, the language, in essence, says that the department may require taxes be withheld and paid over and within a time. The significant language is in a manner other than that required by federal law. My question is, Do we have the authority to delegate that to an agent, that power to an agency, or do we have to be more specific in our law as to what kind of standards we set for the department?
Were you in on the drafting at all, Jim? Do you know what was intended when they used the term federal law there, for what the purpose of this is? Would you take another look at it?
Yeah, the purpose is of that portion is merely to say that under the ordinary withholding deposit requirements, we are tied to the due date under federal law. And under the exceptions that
I have... Representative Hanlon is getting at here, I think.
If I might try and clarify a bit. I think it's fine if we want to give the department some flexibility, and I suppose it is a legal question. Can we give the department that much flexibility in saying that normally the standards are set as in the federal law, but if it doesn't work here, then whatever the department says goes? Or do we have to say that in statute? That's really my question.
I might explain. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not sure I can answer that question. We did have Elizabeth Stockdale at the Attorney General's office draft the proposed language in the bill, and I could maybe have her come over at a future time to go over that with you, if that would be beneficial. The reason that we wanted the legislation written this way is because, as I indicated earlier, the federal government has the authority by regulation to make exceptions, and there are some things that we, as they make the exception, we would like to have the administrative flexibility to piggyback with that without coming back to the legislature 2 years later and doing essentially what we're doing now and saying, now because of a federal change there exists another difference between us and federal. It doesn't make sense, and we'd like to be able to address that.
Mr. Chair, that's the point is, you know, that's great flexibility, but that's not the question. The question is, do we have the power to do that and allow that discretion to the department? Where does it begin and end? I don't know what the chair's intent is on these bills, but it seems to me that's the kind of question that comes up when we designate what rulemaking authority we give and how much of the standard that we set in statute before those rules are drawn up. In this particular case, I'd kind of like an answer to the question. Maybe I can get it up if it's not your intent to make a recommendation, or even if we did make a recommendation to the main committee today, I can get that in the interim, but I'd kind of like to have some guidance on that.
Well, we don't have to move these or make these recommendations immediately, and so we could even, maybe you could even get back to us tomorrow on this, or bring somebody over from the Attorney General's office tomorrow.
I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, and we'll be meeting at 8:30 tomorrow, so if you would be able to be here and bring someone along to clarify this a little bit for us, we could take care of this matter first thing.
This bill is not on the agenda for tomorrow.
Well, we've got 24 hours notice. Okay.
Can we go to work session on the bill tomorrow?
We need that notice for tomorrow, too, wouldn't we?
Yes. I believe in House rules that any bill that's been heard can be taken up at a work session, is that right?
Is that correct, Steve? Without notice?
I'm not sure. I'd have to check on that. We didn't put in the normal language in terms of work session on any bills carried over, or any bills not finished in the agenda for the subcommittee for tomorrow.
Tom, since we are only a subcommittee and must recommend this to the full committee anyway, would it satisfy you, or should it satisfy us is the way I should ask that, to if we had no other problems, to go ahead and recommend this to the full committee, and at that time that it's heard by the full committee, then resolve this one?
I think that would be excellent. I have no objection at all to that.
Okay, would you keep your eye on our schedule and to see when this does come up before the full committee, and be prepared with somebody from the AG's office to address the question that Representative Hanlon has raised. And also, account, but it'd be okay if they contacted you.
Absolutely.
Today or tomorrow sometime to discuss this a little further.
And if that if this is the case, I'm not even sure it requires the formal presentation. If I could get a written response and share it with this sub, that would satisfy me.
Fine. We'll leave that up to you then.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay, any other questions on this bill? Okay, are there any other witnesses to appear on Senate Bill 182? Any other witnesses on any of the bills we've heard? Okay, committee members, then the hearing is closed on Senate Bill 182. And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 181. What is your pleasure?
Well, let's see. We had 180. For the ease of total effort here, I would move Senate Bills 180, 81, and 182 to the full committee with a due pass.
Okay. Any further discussion?
A caveat on the last bill is that if we find out something we don't want to find out, we can always pull back on the full committee on 182. But I think we can move all three of them up into the full committee right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I agree with the motion and will support it.
Clerk will call the roll on the motion, which is to recommend Senate Bill 181, Senate Bill 182, and Senate Bill 180 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representatives Hanlon?
Aye.
Representatives Hugo?
Aye.
And Representative Schoon?
Aye. You must be thinking about any preference on carrying these also, because that would have to be designated as the full committee.
I don't want the one with the ministers in it.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and decide on those right now. I think Senate Bill 180 is the longest and had the most sections. I'll be willing to take that one. Let's see, that leaves Representative Hugo with Senate Bill 181, I think.
Okay, and I'm the one that asked the question on 82, so I get the ministers, right?
Yeah. Okay, but we'll make those recommendations to the full committee, then, too.
Okay.
There being no further items on our agenda, subject to the objection of any committee member, the committee meeting is closed. 8:30 in the morning.